Moncrief on News Talk.
With the all-new Dacia Duster. We've even impressed ourselves with this one.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Time to look at some stories from other parts of the planet. Jonathan de Burka Butler joins us once again. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Sean, how are you getting on?
Right, Tunisia we're going to go to first. And a presidential candidate is going to take part in a runoff from jail.
Yes.
How does that work?
Yeah, it's a strange one. It's the man by the name of Nabil Karoui. He would be more on the secular side of the spectrum, shall we say, just to put you in the picture on that. But there's always been a few question marks around him and how he operates, as there is with many media moguls. He seems to control quite a bit of the media in Tunisia and has even been dubbed the Tunisian Berlusconi. So that'll give you the idea, an idea of the kind of operator.
This is certainly a compliment.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. That'll give you an idea of what some people at least think of him. But anyway, he was arrested back in July of this year. An investigation had been launched into him in 2016 for laundering, money laundering, tax evasion, embezzlement, various different charges.
Okay.
And was arrested back in July, around about the time when he launched his presidential campaign, all right? And he has been in prison ever since August. I think he's been in and out, but he's been in prison ever since August, all right? He ran in the first round of the elections, and he came in the top two. So basically, he'll go into a runoff now against a man by the name of Kais Saied, who would have support from Ennahda. Now, Ennahda would be on the left secular side of the political spectrum, shall we say. So it's a bit of a battle for the hearts and minds of the people of Tunisia. Now, there's a few interesting things about this in that the gap between the two is only about 2%, right? So the guy who came in first, Kais Saied, he came in with 18.4% of the vote, and Nabil Karoui got nearly 16% of the vote, right? So it's going to be a fairly closely run thing, one would suspect, when the two of them go into this runoff on October the 13th.
But legally, he's allowed to take part in the runoff from his
prison cell. The thing was that the election, or the people who were organising the election, they passed him free to run and said absolutely no problem that he runs in the election. And there have been various different appeals. The latest one was launched last week, I think, and it failed. But there's going to be another appeal lodged to try and get him out. So it's difficult to know what the different bodies of government and judiciary and all of this kind of thing, who's fighting against who and what the inner workings are underneath it all.
Is there some sort of constitutional provision for if he doesn't get out, what happens then? Is he
that
still allowed to
know? Because I imagine the reason why he's in there is because he's been detained, he's been charged, but he hasn't been convicted yet.
Yes.
This would allow him to run. So I really don't know.
And if he wins the election, what happens then?
We'll find out around about October 14th or 15th.
One also wonders, is there, if you are elected president in Tunisia, are you immune from prosecution?
Well, you are in Italy, so there might be some other...
that's an ungracious comparison to make.
If he's the Tunisian Berlusconi, didn't Berlusconi use that tactic for years?
Yes, indeed.
To keep himself out of prison. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, Chad, we're going to go to next. And a gold mine has collapsed.
Yes, horrible story, really. It's in a very remote district of Chad called Tibesti, which is up in the north central part of the country. I think it's on the border with Libya, and it's considered to be a fairly lawless part of the world. Now, I haven't found much on the reason why there's a state of emergency. There hasn't been much news about it. There's a state of emergency in that part of the world. I only saw a press release by the US government basically telling people not to go there because there seems to be ethnic and tribal warfare in the region, which is compounded by the fact that there's gold mines in the area and that there's lots of different people going into this lawless area and trying to get gold for themselves.
Oh, crikey,
now, this particular gold mine was illegal. And so there was no oversight of it at all. So you can imagine how dangerous it was. You've got people coming from Sudan with promises of oh, come over here, you'll get yourself rich, and that'll be your passport to Europe. Of course, they get there, they're enslaved, and God knows what kind of human rights abuses are going on in the place. So it's no surprise, although it is extremely sad, that as a result of a mudslide, 30 people have died that we know of in the collapse of this particular illegal gold mine.
Yeah, and in this area, it's pretty lawless, really, is it? Yeah. Kind of cowboy territory. Really,
yes, so the resources in terms of policing and the army resources in Chad are really, really stretched, because you have a separatist movement in the north of the country that are taking resources away from the central government. And then at the other end of the country, down in the south, west of the country near Lake Chad, you basically have the government fighting against branches of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and I'm sure there's a little bit of Boko Haram who nip over the border from Nigeria from time to time and operate out of Chad as well. So, I mean, they've been relying on help from the French, who themselves are a little bit stretched in various other parts of the world, in Africa as well. And they just can't deal with this particular part of the world. If you look across, right across that part of Africa, and these huge countries, Sudan, Chad, Mali, all of these are having these vast, you know, these vast countries have these terrible problems, which just seem to be because of a lack of control, because the countries are just huge.
It's an interesting point, really, if you think about when there's a lot of discussion about the event of a no deal Brexit and policing our own border, which is minuscule compared to the areas that the governments of these kind of countries
and
have to police.
And if you throw into the mix the fact that the only thing that really connects the people in this country is the fact a language that was imposed on them, i.e. French, you know, during imperialism or whatever you want, colonialism, sorry, you know, there's 200 ethnic groups in this one country alone, between 13 million people. So you can imagine the kind of conflict and trouble that causes.
Yeah, crikey. Right, Germany we're going to go to now, and the trial of a far-right terror suspect.
Yes, this is. There's a few of them. In fact, there's 8 altogether. So these are 8 alleged neo-Nazis, as some of the media are referring to them as. And this is the trial that's taking place in Dresden, right? So these guys basically put together a plot last year that they were going to go to Berlin on the 3rd of October and were going to wreak havoc. They had a deadly plan, as some media are reporting it. Thankfully, the men who are aged between 21 and 32 were caught and were arrested on October the 1st. And so the plan was scuppered and didn't go ahead, obviously. So now they're going on trial, and as you can imagine, it's getting quite a bit of media coverage.
Yeah, and the attack in Berlin, are there any details about specifically what that attack was?
Yeah, I think basically they had guns organised, there was plans for bombs as well, and this is how they were intercepted, because they were talking about this on an internet chat room. The authorities got into that chat room and were able to arrest them. So it was a lucky, but I suppose positive outcome. Now, I suppose, you know, it all goes back to the fact that there seems to be a rise of the right in certain parts of Germany that people are particularly concerned about, if you're concerned about this kind of thing, of course.
Yeah.
So this is just another example of it.
Yeah. Well, interesting, though, that given that the far right in Germany have done, you know, seem to be doing well electorally, that there might be a violent component to it is a bit more disturbing.
Well, yes, indeed.
Extremely disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely. But it wouldn't be the first case. There's been a few things going on there that are disturbing and something that needs to be watched. Mm.
Though in Austria,
yes,
far right party there didn't do so well.
Yeah,
that's what you get for hanging out with Russians all the time. Chechnya, we're going to go to now, and they're claiming there's a witch hunt there.
Well, there is. As you know, Ramzan Kadyrov is a headbanger. He's the president.
he's been there
for 8 years, I think. Mm. And he is an absolute unapologetic homophobe. Has his own interpretation of Islamic law that he likes to use to do what he wants, effectively. And one of the things that he set up about 5 or 6 years ago was an institution called the Islamic Medical Institute, right? And that was specifically put together by himself and a local clerical leadership who obviously agreed with his interpretation of laws to counter sorcerers and witches. right?
Yeah.
In July, the president decided that they weren't doing enough, and hey presto, there's been a number of arrests ever since. So specifically in this case, three elderly people have been detained, and they've been brought in front of television in Chechnya and have admitted to their crimes.
So it's literally witches he's looking for now.
Witches and sorcerers, yes. So there's two women and one man. So the two, one woman and the man are basically accused of trying to evoke evil spirits or something like that. That's one of them. And another woman gave advice to a client, we'll call her client, said that she should take a bath in chicken broth to get rid of evil spirits. And this apparently is a crime.
Yeah. And is this being predicated on the idea that sorcerers and witches are real, or that they're, you know, they're just conning people out of their money?
Well, that was one of the arguments, actually, that some people put forward. But it was pointed out to those people that there's already legislation dealing with that kind of thing. I suppose that might be tarot cards or whatever you want. I don't know, because there are people who might do that kind of thing who wouldn't be bona fide tarot card readers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's been pointed out to them. But they said, no, that this is just, you know, this is folklore, this is whatever you want, it's, you know, old wives' tales,
literally.
And
yeah,
and these people are being it's been taken seriously, but it's just to put fear into people. It's how this guy operates.
Yeah. And so they basically hadn't arrested anybody, and then he said during the summer, oh come on, we need to arrest some people, and out of nowhere. And what kind of sentences can you get for being a witch in
Chechnya? I don't know. That I don't know. But when that institute was first launched back in 2013, people... So it's funny and everything in certain aspects of it, but people have gone missing because of this institute. So it's pretty sinister stuff.
Yeah, and he also fancies himself, I think, as a hip-hop star as well. And he has videos of himself working out and...
Oh, sure, that's normal,
various,
isn't it?
That part of the world. Yeah. Right, okay, Russia we're going to go to now, and they've banned smoking on balconies.
They have. They've brought in new legislation that bans smoking on balconies, which has caused a bit of a stir, as you can imagine, given that there's 35 million smokers in Russia. About 60% of those are men and 22% of them are women. There's a lot of people who aren't happy about it, because, as you know, most people live in high-rise apartment blocks there.
Yeah.
So where are they supposed to go for a cigarette? But yes, this law has been brought in. Under new rules, open fire is apparently prohibited on apartment balconies. And originally when the legislation came in, people in the tobacco industry surmised that, oh, it's just for, you know, people who are going out and cooking kebabs on barbecues or whatever the case might be. But when push came to shove, they were told, no, it includes smokers out on balconies, so you won't be able to do it anymore.
And is this health legislation specifically, or more just kind of burning down these buildings?
Well, I think they're putting it forward initially as being there's a fire hazard, but there has been legislation since about 2013 to stop people from smoking. So they brought in bans on smoking in bars and public spaces and that kind of thing. And given that between 400,000 and 500,000 people die every year from smoking-related illnesses, and Putin himself has said that he wants to do something about it, I think it's probably more to do with health.
Yeah. Though at the same time, is there much pushback on this or indications of that? Because it's oftentimes the things you don't suspect that suddenly causes a massive revolt.
Well, this is it. I mean, they have a sort of a group, right? So there's a guy called Andrei Loskutov, apparently, who is the head of the All-Russian Movement for Smokers' Rights. And he's basically pointed out that they're stopping us from smoking everywhere, and now we can't even smoke in our balconies. But most people seem to suggest that they're just going to have to suck it up and take the legislation and go with it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Putin has said that he wants to ban people who are born after 2014 from buying cigarettes. So he wants an outright ban.
Okay. Mm. That would be the first country in the world to do that.
Probably,
that would be
quite
extraordinary. But then again, just based on the weather we had today in Russia, why would you go out in your balcony to have a cigarette, really? Uzbekistan, and a story about the cotton harvest there, though it's being produced through forced labour.
Yes.
Not the first time, one imagines, in Uzbekistan, historically speaking.
No, it's not. And it's actually caused a bit, it's something we've spoken about before, but not for a long time, actually, because to be honest with you, even though I've been looking at it, I thought it was gone, this practice. And that's mainly because the president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, has basically warned governors and warned them as recently as August that they're not to let people out into the fields to pick cotton anymore. So what they used to do was they used to go shut down schools, colleges, and they'd go into places, usually public organisations like tax offices or whatever it might be, and they'd say, come on out and do your shift for the month. We need to get the cotton harvest in. But it wasn't paid for. But what happened was the companies cottoned on to this, if you'll excuse the pun, and they decided we're no longer going to buy your cotton anymore. So about 160 companies, good few years ago now, signed a declaration saying that they weren't going to take cotton from Uzbekistan. So eventually, because of this pressure, the government authorities started to act, but it doesn't seem to be enough. There's been at least three reports so far this year of people being taken out of companies. No school reports or college reports now at this stage, but out of companies and being brought out into fields and being made to work.
Yeah, that seems to be almost like a cultural hangover from the Soviet period, where they were expected to do that, because that basically Uzbekistan was just one big cotton producer.
Yeah, absolutely. And it still is a massive cotton producer. I mean, it produces about $1 billion worth of cotton every year. And the thing about it is, even though 160 companies have said, we're not going to buy your cotton, there's other markets. So they sell huge amounts of cotton to Bangladesh and China, where the checks mightn't be as regular, and also where, you know, the end product might be bought by companies from the West as well. But it's just they don't go through the checks and balances.
That? Exactly. Yes, that's a very good point. Though I suppose on the other hand, like the economy of Uzbekistan depends on it so much.
It does. And they don't have the people to do it. So this is the problem, and they can't pay them the wages because they can't compete then. So what do you do?
Right. Finally, Laos we're going to, and a woman has been arrested for criticising the government's response to the floods.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It's one of these bizarre stories. You know, Laos is one of those countries where you just can't say a thing or you'll be arrested. So this is a 30-year-old woman by the name of Mua Huang Jayabuli. Sorry. She took to Facebook in the middle of September and went on a 13-minute rant saying that the government hadn't done enough to take care of people who had been affected in floods that had happened earlier in September. Now, these were extensive. I have to say, until recently, I hadn't heard that much about them. But, I mean, 500,000 people have been displaced. 14 people have died so far that we know of. And it seems to be kind of an extraordinary event. But she was criticising the government because they didn't respond. It got 150,000 views on Facebook. They were not happy about it.
Yeah.
And she was arrested and she's still in prison. Her family have said that they haven't been in touch with her. Charges are going to be levelled at her and she could end up being in prison for anything between 1 to 5 years.
Charges of what?
Well, under Article 117 of the Lao Penal Code.
Oh, 117 again. You know,
it is, absolutely. She defamed Laos and apparently she has connections with bad elements inside the country and outside. These guys are very good at getting at people who are outside the country as well. A man in Thailand last month disappeared after he appeared, and I think on Facebook or some other social media, criticising the government over other policies that they have.
But of course, if she hadn't got 150,000 likes, then this might have happened.
No, absolutely
it's not just her, it's the people she represents. So what should we look out for in the coming week, Jonathan?
Yeah, it's not much. I mean, there's all sorts of, as usual, Trump will be doing something and Boris Johnson will be doing something. So besides that, Angela Merkel and Mark Rutte of the Netherlands will be meeting on Wednesday, no doubt, to discuss what mad stuff Boris Johnson has come up with and all the rest of it. There's assembly elections, general election basically in Portugal on Sunday. They could be relatively interesting as well. And on Saturday, it's Global Teachers Day. It's World Teachers Day. So maybe get your teacher, your favourite teacher, an apple on Friday or something.
Yeah, it's weird that it's World Teachers Day on the day they have off.
Indeed. Yeah, so you can't thank them.
Jonathan, thanks so much for coming into us. Jonathan DeBurke-Butler. We'll take a break. Back in a sec.